on the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Right here on Register Radio, it's another historic trip for Pope Francis. He has a full itinerary as a messenger of mercy. Jeanette DeMello and Register Rome correspondent Edward Penton discussed the Holy Father's quick stop in Cuba and his six-day trip to Mexico. And Lent has started. Jeanette and Register columnist Father Dwight Longenecker focus on how we can all enter Lent more fully. Welcome to Register Radio, a co-production of EWTN and the National Catholic Register. I'm the producer of the show, Elena Rodriguez, sitting in for Tom Price. Our editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register, Jeanette DeMello, is right here and ready to bring us history in the making. Thanks for joining us, Jeanette. Our first guest is the Register's Rome correspondent, Edward Penton. He began reporting on the Pope and the Vatican with Vatican Radio before joining the Register team more than 10 years ago. He has also reported for a number of other publications, including Newsweek, Newsmax, and the Catholic Herald. This week, he is reporting on the Pope's busy itinerary at the start of Lent. Jeanette?
Well, Edward, it's been a very busy week in Rome. Obviously, it's the beginning of Lent, and that has with it many responsibilities that the Pope must do there in Rome. But he has now left Rome, and he's on his way to Mexico with a very important stop in Havana, Cuba. Now, this stop is for Pope Francis to meet the Russian Orthodox Patriarch Kirill of Moscow. And this is a historic meeting. Why? Why is this so significant?
Right. Well, this has been in the making, in the works for a long, long time, Jeanette. It's been, for at least for the last 20 years, popes have been trying to get this meeting. First of all, John Paul II, and then Benedict XVI. It never came to fruition for a variety of reasons. It's very historical, of course, because this is the first meeting that between a pope and the patriarch, the Russian patriarch, since before the 10th century. So it's a hugely historic event. And strangely, I mean, it's very odd, I think, for a lot of people to think that a patriarch and a pope have never met for a millennium. Right. But that's the case, and that's because of the depths of the differences that have been over history between the two churches. So this makes it all incredibly historic. But some people have said, you know, well, we mustn't get too put the cart before the horse a bit, because it is a very there are problems, you know, still around, and there are still obstacles. There are still concerns from both sides which haven't been resolved. So there's sort of people saying, especially from the Ukrainian side, that we mustn't expect too much from this meeting, but it is certainly a good start. And as somebody said, you know, if the church is to be a force in the world for reconciliation, well, then it must at least be able to meet each other, internally, and have those conflicts resolved first. So so it could be a great boost to the church's interaction, really, with the world at large, at least further down the line.
Now, we have to, you know, let our listeners know we're having this conversation before the meeting actually takes place. And so we don't know what they're talking about, but we could talk about why this meeting is taking place now. Why is this finally coming together?
Right. Well, I think that you could basically put them down to three reasons. First of all, both churches are very concerned about the West and the decline of morality in the West through secularism, and there's a concerted effort by both of them to really unite and deal with that. Secondly, there's the whole issue of Christian persecution around the world, which is getting very serious, especially in the Middle East. And so there's a concern there to have a united front against that. But also there is, from the Orthodox side, there's a Pan-Orthodox Council coming up, which is another immensely historic meeting for the Orthodox Church, because this is the first time that they've had such a meeting since 787. So that's a huge meeting for them. And in order to, there's a whole lot of politicking behind that, in the sense that the Russian Orthodox are constantly competing, really, with the Ecumenical Patriarchate, which is another Orthodox wing of the Orthodox Church. And they've been losing ground, and to have them, with the Pan-Orthodox Council coming up, they want to sort of reassert themselves and to be seen to be carrying as much weight as the Ecumenical Patriarch, which has always had good relations with Rome and has always, the Patriarch has always met the Pope, or at least has done for the last 50 years. So there is that sort of background to it. But there's a lot of complex reasons as well behind this, and we probably can't go into all of them now.
Just real quick to help our readers to understand, what is the Pan-Orthodox Council that will happen this June?
Right. Well, this is a meeting between all the heads of the what's called autocephalous churches, which are self-governing churches. I think there's about 15 of them in the Orthodox Church. And they're basically meeting for the first time, all of them around a table. And this hasn't happened, as I said, since over a millennium. So, and what it is they're only discussing not really controversial subjects, which have been issues of division in the past, but they're discussing various issues which they want to really discuss, which have been on the table for a long time. This meeting has been really in the works since the 1970s.
Wow.
But it's only coming to fruition now. And it's really a way to try and bring unity to the Orthodox Church, which wasn't there before. I mean, they've always been a certain amount of unity, but but they've always had their differences, of course. So hopefully there'll be fruits from that as well, a certain push for unity, which obviously helps the Catholic Church too, because if it's a unified force, it helps the Church dialogue with the Orthodox in a more concrete way.
Very good. Well, we pray that meeting actually happens, because it's obvious that it's been very difficult and long in coming, and we do pray that it actually happens this summer. So this is Jeanette DiMello on Register Radio. I'm speaking to Edward Penton, our Rome correspondent, and we're talking about the Pope's itinerary this week. The Pope is on his way to Mexico, Edward, and he's going to be there for a 6-day trip. What are some of the highlights of his trip?
Right, yes, it's going to be a really intensive trip, a lot of travel. He's going from the top to the bottom of the country and taking in 6 stops. So he's going to be in only 5 days. So it's going to be a very busy trip. And after each stop, he'll be going back to Mexico City where he's staying. So, but what's particularly interesting about this trip is it really is a bridge-building trip to the peripheries. I mean, he really is going to those who are really suffering. So he's going to a border town which has been stricken by violence for several years, the border town with El Paso in Texas. Then he'll be going to the south, which is a very impoverished part of the country. And he'll also be going to a very drug-related, violence-ridden suburb of Mexico City. And he'll also be visiting prisons and young people and celebrating many masses there as well. So it's going to be a very intense trip, but one which is very much characteristic of Pope Francis in the terms of him going out to the peripheries and really going to these people who are really struggling and in need.
Yes, many people have said there's a lot of symbolism in the places that he is going. I think it's called Chiapas is a place that has it's in the region very poor. They have lost many Catholics in that region to Pentecostalism, and it's a place where he will have a mass with the poor workers, and so hopefully that bears new fruit in renewing their faith. He's also going, of course, to the shrine, the Basilica of Our Lady of Guadalupe, which is very important to Pope Francis.
Yes, he said on the plane going over to Mexico today that that's one of the highlights for him for his trip, and he really wants to spend time in front of Our Lady there praying to her. So that's, in fact, after he says Mass there on his first full day in the capital, he's going to spend time just in prayer. And he's not going to have any engagements for that evening. So that's a big highlight for him. But yes, it is a lot going on in this visit. And also the interesting, one of the big highlights will be when he goes to the border town. Immigration, of course, is very important in the U.S. presidential elections. And, of course, that's going to be very significant in what he's going to say there. And there's going to be 200,000 pilgrims, they think, from the Mexican side, and 50,000 from the U.S. side. So it'll be quite an interesting liturgy, I think, in the fact that it'll bring people from Mexico and the U.S. to that.
Yes, this is in the city Juarez, just right on the border near El Paso, as you mentioned before. I think it's going to be a very important part of this trip, and surely there'll be many people in the United States listening to what he has to say about immigration. The Pope, he doesn't shy away from difficult topics, and he's promised to speak about them on this trip, hasn't he, Edward?
Yes, he has. And I think the two probably, well, he's certainly going to be discussing the problems of corruption. The current government in Mexico is rather unpopular at the moment because it's been embroiled in certain corruption scandals. And so I think he's going to speak out about that, obviously in an indirect way, as popes often do, but get the point across. But also the violence as well, the drug-related violence, as many will know that Mexico has suffered from that for many years. And in fact, he'll be going to a place called Morelia, which is the capital of Michoacán State, which has been torn apart by drug-related violence in recent years.
So, Edward, thank you so much for being with us today.
Okay, thanks for having me on.
And thank you, Edward Penton and Jeanette DeMello. When we return, making this your best Lent ever, we talk to a priest who will challenge you to live Lent more fully, and he tells us how. Are you up for the challenge? This is Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. We'll be right back.
As he travels to Mexico, Pope Francis offers a special blessing to Mother Angelica.
To Mother Angelica, with my blessing, and I ask you to pray for me. I need it. God bless you, Mother Angelica.
His Holiness, Pope Francis. EWTN Radio. Live truth. Live Catholic.
In today's world, we have all kinds of misinformation and even disinformation about Christianity, Catholicism, and religion in general. And we need a source that is going to give us direct quotations and authentic news about what is going on in the church, so we know what the Pope really said and not what the media said he said. We need to know what the Synod is doing, what the encyclicals mean, in order to be able to give the facts of our faith. For that reason, we need the National Catholic Register, which will give us the good news along with the hard news of our world today. And in that way, we can have what we need to go out to our world and give them the good news of Jesus Christ.
For a free 6-issue trial of the National Catholic Register, go to EWTN.com and click on the banner for the Register, or call 800-421-3230 for your 6 free issues.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. Along with Jeanette DeMello, I'm Elena Rodriguez. Our next guest is Father Dwight Longenecker. He was ordained an Anglican priest in England, and in 1995, Father Dwight and his family were received into the Catholic Church. He has since become a prolific writer and author of several books, including Challenging Catholics, More Christianity, Quest for the Creed, and The Gargoyle Code. In December 2006, he was ordained a Catholic priest under the special pastoral provision for married former Anglican clergy. He is now the parish priest of Our Lady of the Rosary Parish in Greenville, South Carolina. Father Dwight Longenecker is here with us to challenge us to live Lent more fully. Jeanette?
Father Dwight, I know that Lent is a very busy time for priests. There's extra confessions, there's Stations of the Cross, and oftentimes missions that parish priests are doing. So thank you very much for spending this time with us on Register Radio.
Happy to be with you.
You know, recently, thank you also for your columns, because you're just a regular contributor, and we're so grateful for that. And recently you gave us quite a bit of food for thought, or maybe I should say material for meditation and action this Lent, and in a couple of columns. And the first one I wanted to talk about is called Fasting, Lent, and the Purpose of Prayer, and that went up this week online. You offered in that column various models of saintly practices, sacrificial practices. And one of those examples was of the Desert Fathers. So I wanted to talk about who are these Desert Fathers? Who are these men and how did they live?
Well, in the 4th century, people who know their history will remember that Christianity became the state religion of the Roman Empire in the beginning of the 300s, beginning of the 4th century. And when the emperor and his mother became Christian, suddenly, rather than being tossed to the lions, the Christians were being lionized. In other words, they were being praised, and the emperor built basilicas, and it was suddenly fashionable to be a Christian. And so in response to this, there were some men and women, I should add, who said, you know, we need to go back to the simplicity and a call. We need to be like John the Baptist and go out and live in the desert and really return to apostolic simplicity, fast and pray, because they were noticing that along with Christianity becoming popular, it was also becoming worldly.
And their lifestyle was rather difficult. I mean, they didn't have much, and they spent their entire lives out in the desert. That's a very difficult model to follow.
You know, the word's rather difficult. You should be an English person because they're very good at understatement. the desert fathers were actually very extreme. They lived in caves. They had very little clothing. They did repetitious work like making baskets, which they linked in with their prayer and making prayer mats. They were vegetarian. They ate very little. And also they were prone to excessive physical mortification, which is a long way of saying they would do things like throw themselves into nettle bushes and thorn bushes and, you know, whip themselves and all that kind of stuff. And so this is actually very interesting. After the Desert Fathers, the Syrian monks began to champion something called stylites. They, in other words, they lived on top of a pillar. St. Simeon Stylites, toward the end of the 4th century, lived for 37 years on top of a column, a pillar, in the middle of the Syrian desert. They really took their asceticism to an extreme. And my column comments on that and says that while they were very holy men and women, and they really were seeking God, their thought and their theology was actually influenced by Manichaeism, which is a heresy from that time period, which said that the physical world was evil. And so they were influenced by that, and that led them to the extremes of asceticism, I believe, that they were prone to.
But your column also talks about another way. It's maybe a way of slightly correcting the asceticism of the Desert Fathers, and that's the way of Saint Benedict. What model does he offer?
Well, this is very interesting historically because Benedict follows on from the Desert Fathers about the beginning of the 6th century, around the 500s. Just after that, Benedict in Italy responds against the very harsh asceticism of the desert monks in both Egypt and in Syria. And he says in his rule, famously, that there should be nothing which is harsh, nothing which is burdensome. And so he steers a middle course and says, we do need to have an austere life, a simple life. But his theology is much more positive about the created world, which it should be, because God created the whole world and he created the physical world. And he did not step out on the sixth day of creation and say, that's junk. He said,
right,
that's good. And so the Benedictine way affirms the goodness of life, affirms the goodness of God's gifts, and says that fasting, which we all are meant to do during Lent, is a way to correct our disordered affections, because the sin is not in loving physical pleasure and loving physical things. The sin is in loving them too much or in loving them the wrong way. So we become too attached to our material things. We become too self-indulgent. Fasting and almsgiving corrects those tendencies. It doesn't say those things are wrong. It just, by giving generously and by fasting, we're drawing back and we're correcting. It's kind of like the way an athlete would do when they're training, or a soldier would do when they're training for battle, or training for physical, for athletics. They restrict their diet. They take exercise. They discipline themselves in order to be able to be the champions.
This is Jeanette DeMello on Register Radio. I'm speaking with Father Dwight Longenecker, who is a blogger and columnist at The Register. And we're talking about a recent column called Fasting, Lent, and the Purpose of Prayer. And I want to get to that very last part, the purpose of prayer, Father Dwight. I mean, these sacrifices that we do during Lent are intimately tied and should be intimately tied to prayer. What's the purpose of it all?
Well, you know, I'm afraid a lot of us have an immature and sometimes a superstitious understanding of prayer, that prayer is us sort of saying the right words so that God will be happy and give us what we want. Someone described it as the vending machine approach. You put your prayer in the top, and what you want pops out the bottom. And there's nothing wrong with asking God for what we need. God tells us to do that. So don't get me wrong. I'm not knocking that. I'm just saying that God wants to draw us further into a deeper kind of prayer in which our will has become conformed to his will, so that the heart of our prayer is, thy will be done. Thy will be done. So as we pray, and our fasting and our almsgiving is a way to discipline ourselves in the physical realm so that that prayer of thy will be done, not my will be done, becomes more active in our lives.
So really what we're trying to do is just create more space, in a way, space, interior space, and space in our physical lives as well for God.
That's a good way of putting it. Our lives are cluttered with all this stuff, and we can't therefore see God clearly and be in communion with him clearly. And fasting and almsgiving helps us to clear out some of the junk.
Yeah, it's very important, and I feel like I need to declutter in my life right now. So it's a much needed time of life, and so grateful to have this in a cyclical way every year, this opportunity. Now this year there's a special emphasis on mercy, because our Holy Father Pope Francis has asked us in a special way to celebrate mercy this year, to do mercy this year. And you wrote a piece about the price of mercy, and that ran in our print edition, February 7th print edition, and is up online this weekend. And you know, it talks about God's mercy as being a part of his great, great generosity, but it also talks about the cost of that mercy. What is the cost of mercy?
Well, every time we look at a crucifix, we see the cost of mercy. In other words, God so loved the world that he sent his only begotten Son so that whoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. That's John 3:16, probably the most famous verse of the Bible, and that expresses God's great mercy, but it does come at a price. And I think in our modern, pretty self-indulgent and rich American society, we have got used to having everything our way. You know, it's kind of like, wasn't that a Burger King slogan, have it your way?
Yeah.
And so we have this kind of culture in which we're used to having everything our own way and everything delivered pretty much as we want it on a platter and without too much trouble. That's not the idea of mercy. We can sometimes get the wrong idea of mercy and thinking that it's just God handing out some sweets for us and some candy, and that's nice. Yeah, we'll line up and get it. Well, the price of mercy from our point of view also is that we come to receive that mercy on our knees. We come in the confessional. We come with true contrition. And if we don't have true contrition, then it's difficult for God to give us true mercy, because there's other stuff blocking and standing in the way.
Well, true contrition, I mean, sometimes it's hard to understand. I guess maybe it's hard to be honest with yourself about what true contrition is. You know, we go to confession, many of us do it perhaps out of a sense of habit, of just kind of psychologically knowing we need it, and it's a good way of being a Catholic. It's a good Catholic practice. But that's not necessarily perfect or true contrition. What is true contrition?
Well, imperfect contrition is when we go to confession either out of duty, or we go because we feel guilty or ashamed or scared we're going to get caught. And a lot of times, therefore, that has to do only with the sins where we lose control. The sexual sins, overeating, overdrinking, losing our temper. Those are the sins that we're most ashamed of, because actually we're proud. We have self-esteem issues, and those sins are the main sins which, when we look in the mirror, we feel bad about. Now, it's good to feel bad about that. Don't get me wrong, but that's what the church calls imperfect contrition. In other words, it's only the first step. Perfect contrition, very simply, is when we're sorry for our sin because we understand how much it has offended and hurt God. So it's the perfect contrition is the sort of thing that you would feel if you insulted and hurt your mother, and you see the look of pain and sadness in her eyes, and suddenly you go, oh my gosh, I can't believe I did that. I'm sorry, Mom. I hurt somebody who loves me. Now, then we're getting towards perfect contrition, where we actually are sorry for our sin because it's offended God.
Sure. So we're not just embarrassed that we acted that way. We are actually concerned about the other, truly concerned about what we've done.
And we can only get to that point, you see, when we actually love God enough to be sorry that we've offended his love. And if we aren't at that point in our spiritual lives where we really learn to love God, then our contrition will probably continue to be imperfect.
Now, Father Dwight, this is a perfect conversation at the beginning of Lent, because we have time to meditate in a way that maybe helps us to get to that perfect contrition. I'm sure it takes many years sometimes, but what are good ways of meditating that could help us get there? And we don't have much time, but maybe just a tip.
Well, you know, I always bounce people back to the rosary, and I might mention my book, Praying the Rosary for Inner Healing. That is a book which has helped thousands of people already to pray the rosary in a new way, which helps them remove the barriers to experiencing God's love and to therefore enter into God's love more fully. When I say we need to love God, as you know, to get to the point of perfect contrition, we can only do that by experiencing how much he loves us. And getting to that point, I think the rosary is a tried and true method. Also, just taking a little bit more time at Mass, arriving earlier to pray, staying a little bit later to pray, spending some time in the church to light a candle before your favorite saint, or saying an extra Hail Mary before the image of the Blessed Mother. All of these traditional Catholic things, if we just take a little bit more effort, God is ready to pour out his mercy upon us. We just have to make that little bit of effort to put ourselves in the right place.
Father Dwight, it's the beginning of Lent, and we have a lot of time to practice what you have suggested to us. Thank you so much for being with us on Register Radio.
It's great to be with you. Thank you, and God bless you and your listeners.
And thank you both, Father Dwight Longenecker and Jeanette DeMello. Don't miss revealing insights of Pope Francis' pastoral visit to Mexico and his historic visit with Russian Patriarch Kirill on ncregister.com. Hey, and do you know of anyone who may want to hear Register Radio? Point them to ncregister.com and click on the radio tab to listen or even to download the show. All Register Radio shows are archived there. On behalf of Jeanette DeMello, Edward Penton, Father Dwight Longenecker, Tom Price, and all of us here at the Register and at EWTN Radio, thank you for joining us. This is Elena Rodriguez, and we will be here again next week for more of Register Radio.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.